The following program is not a production of Audio Journal. External programs like this are selected with the interests of our audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed in this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
Hello, and welcome to the Women's Hour. I'm Mary Ellen. Thank you for joining me. Beginning today with Women's Day. Why women are dressing happier again. From colorful dresses to playful accessories, dopamine dressing is helping women boost confidence, improve mood, and rediscover joy in getting dressed. By Megan B. Murphy. After years of neutral basics, comfort dressing, and quiet luxury, I've noticed something shifting lately. Women seem ready to have fun with fashion again. Yay! And I am too. Recently, I wore a pink gingham dress to the Today Show that felt straight out of a summertime picnic fantasy, complete with purple heels. Another day, I showed up to a luncheon in strawberry print pants and a fuzzy pink cardigan covered in giant strawberries. And here's the funny thing. In a room full of incredibly accomplished women, including best-selling authors, TV personalities, and podcast hosts, the conversation starter wasn't work. It was the strawberry sweater. People smiled. They laughed. They asked where it was from. That's the magic of what's known as dopamine dressing, or wearing clothes that genuinely lift your mood and spark joy, not just for you, but often for the people around you, too. I've written about this philosophy for years in Your Fully Charged Life. Long before dopamine dressing became a social media buzzword, I believed in the idea of dressing up to feel up, using color, texture, and playful fashion to create energy and confidence from the outside in. And there's actual science behind it. Researchers use the term enclothed cognition to describe the way clothing can influence our mood, confidence, behavior, and even performance. In other words, what we wear affects how we feel inside our bodies and how we move through the world. A bright dress can make you stand taller. A bold lipstick can make you feel more confident walking into a meeting. A joyful outfit can shift your energy before you even say a word. But lately, I've started to realize there may be another benefit too. Joyful clothing can become a connection point in an increasingly lonely world. Fashion used to feel intimidating or exclusive. Now, the most memorable pieces often feel playful and approachable. The strawberry sweater invited people in. It made strangers smile. It started conversations. And that's part of why I've been so drawn lately to clothes that embrace color and personality in a really, really fearless way. Pieces covered in oversized florals, tropical fruit, dogs, birds, and wildly joyful prints that almost feel designed to spark conversation. Some pieces look like wearable art. Others simply make you laugh. And maybe that's the point. In a world where so many interactions feel transactional, rushed, or isolated, there's something kind of wonderful about clothing that helps people connect. A colorful dress, a whimsical sweater, a pair of pants covered in strawberries. They become tiny invitations for people to engage, compliment, laugh, and share. That doesn't mean everyone suddenly needs to dress like a human fruit basket. Dopamine dressing looks different for everyone. For some women, it's a bold tropical print dress. For others, it's simply swapping black workout clothes for something cheerful, or adding one bright accessory that makes getting dressed feel more fun. The point isn't to chase trends. It's to reconnect with pieces that make you feel more like yourself. Because after several heavy years, pandemic stress, caregiving stress, world stress, I think many women are craving joy wherever they can find it, even in their closets. From NPR, construction is a man's game. These women are demolishing the barriers. By Christopher Clark. On the busy workshop floor at Furniture International on the outskirts of Nairobi, workers often have to shout to be heard over the din of circular saws, hammers, and machinery. "At first, I was very shy," says 24-year-old machine operator Diana Ojambo. Slight, with a blue bandana tied over long braids, as she feeds cabinet panels through a PVC edger. "I didn't know how to stand in front of people and speak up, but now I can." Nearby, amid a sea of male co-workers, three other women sand and assemble cabinetry, while 23-year-old supervisor Jane Mwangi moves between stations, checking measurements and overseeing progress. Barely a year ago, none of these women had ever worked in the industry. Ojambo had never worked alongside men before. Women remain a rarity across Kenya's building trades, even as a frenetic construction boom, particularly in Nairobi, has helped turn the sector into a multi-billion dollar industry. According to figures from Kenya's National Construction Authority, women accounted for just 3% of the country's accredited construction artisans. Those who do enter the sector are mostly confined to lower-paid, informal jobs, carrying water, hauling sand, or cleaning sites, rather than trained for more specialized roles. Women are also typically saddled with the vast majority of unpaid caregiving and household work in a country that continues to battle long-held assumptions about gender roles. Build Her, a Nairobi-based nonprofit, is trying to change that. The organization runs year-long training, and internship programs in carpentry, tiling, painting, and other finishing trades, helping women access steadier, better paid work in the sector. Since its inception in 2019, BuildHER says it has trained more than 1,000 women, with graduates increasing their average daily earnings roughly 5 to 6-fold within a year of training, from about $1.50 to between $11 and $12. A 2024 study by Dahlberg, a global development advisory firm, found that about 65% of BuildHER graduates were still working in construction 12 months after completing the program. I've seen women get stuck in low-paying jobs, and it was like a mental barrier where they couldn't see the potential right in front of them, says architect and BuildHER co-founder Tatu Gater. So I wanted to help women see that. For many women, Gater says, simply hearing about others succeeding in the trades can make the idea feel possible. As a result, much of BuildHER's growth has spread through word of mouth, as graduates encourage friends and neighbors to apply. Ojambo, a single mother of two young children, was unemployed and struggling to make ends meet when she first heard about BuildHER from a friend in the informal settlement of Kibera, where she lives. "My life was so challenging," she says. "But now I can support myself. I can support my kids." Ojambo is already looking forward to the future. Within the next year, she hopes to start her own carpentry business in Kibera. "Inside this company, some of the men still think we ladies are not fit for this kind of work," she says, gesturing towards some of her co-workers. "But if you know what you want and believe in yourself, you show them that whatever they can do, you can do better." Sticking to it. Early on a clear weekday morning, clusters of young women gather outside the cobalt blue doors of BuildHER's training center inside Spectrum Business Park, a network of warehouse buildings with green corrugated roofs in Nairobi's bustling Baba Dogo industrial area. Orientation for new intake of students has just wrapped up. In a conference hall near the entrance, 16 trainees settle into plastic chairs for an introductory presentation on solar installation, a course launched this year as BuildHER expands into additional technical trades. In a neighboring warehouse unit, trainees crouch over a concrete floor, spreading tile adhesive into thin gray patches before dragging notched trowels through it to create neat ridges. Trainer Robert Ndungu moves between them, occasionally kneeling to demonstrate the correct technique. The women scrape the adhesive back into buckets, and the exercise begins again. These women come here knowing nothing about tiling. By the end of this training, they are able to work, earn money, and improve the life of their family, Ndungu says. "That really inspires me." But Build Her co-founder, Gater, says learning a trade is often only one part of the challenge facing women. Many arrive here carrying pressures that extend far beyond the workshop floor, from childcare and deep financial instability to resistance at home from husbands or parents uneasy about women doing construction work. Others find it hard to imagine themselves feeling safe in male-dominated workplaces where harassment is often rife. Reflecting on her own experiences as an architect, Gater notes that even as women increasingly entered leadership positions within their firms, construction sites remained hostile environments. You're supposed to be a decision maker, but you'd still be getting catcalled and harassed by men, she says. Those experiences, combined with feedback from trainees and employers, have helped shape Build Her's broader approach to preparing women not only technically, but also emotionally and physically for work in the industry. Elsewhere on campus, bass-heavy dance music pulses from a crowded gym class where an energetic instructor leads around 30 trainees through squats, stretches, and lifting drills. Across the courtyard, a similarly sized group gathers in a large warehouse for a yoga and mindfulness session, sitting cross-legged on their mats as another instructor shares tips on staying focused and remaining calm under pressure. Build Her also employs a mental health coach and on-site nutritionist. While trainees attend group wellness sessions every 2 weeks, support systems shaped directly by feedback about the difficulties many women faced, both at home and in the workplace. Dahlberg's research, based on a survey of 354 women working in the construction industry, suggests such investments are paying off. Build Her graduates reported not only higher incomes after completing the program, but also greater participation in household decision-making and stronger community support. They also take more pride in what they do, says Naoko Koyama, a Dahlberg partner who worked on the report, adding that the combination of technical and soft skills training offers a model for other male-dominated industries. One of the women taking part in today's yoga class is 27-year-old Ruth Chiari, a single mother who joined Build Her's painting and decorating cohort just 2 weeks earlier. Chiari first became interested in painting while helping to renovate classrooms in Kibera, where she also lives, as part of a community leadership project. At the same time, caring for her autistic daughter has made her think differently about color and space. One day, she hopes to work in color psychology, advising families and businesses on how different colors affect mood and behavior. You don't have to just do blue or pink, she says. We can create more colors. All about the mindset. Sprawling across 5,000 acres of former coffee plantations, about 12 miles north of Nairobi, Tattoo City, a private mixed-use development of housing estates, factories, schools, and office parks, is the most ambitious symbol of Kenya's rapidly changing urban landscape. For Build Her, developments like Tattoo City have become an important testing ground for its broader ambitions. Around 50 trainees worked on finishing and interior jobs inside Eneo at Tattoo Central, a sleek glass front office complex near the development's entrance that now houses a growing cluster of Kenyan and international companies. The tiling contractor was so impressed with the quality of the women's work that he employed 7 of them full-time, says Pumi Lukeli, head of stakeholder engagement at Gateway Real Estate Africa, or GREY, which developed the building. She says contractors were equally impressed by the women's professionalism and ability to take feedback, which she attributes to Build Her's broader approach to training. Tattoo City is one of roughly 150 employers that Build Her currently works with in and around Nairobi, as the organization pushes to expand women's participation in a far larger share of the construction industry. The hope is to increase women's participation in skilled construction jobs from the current roughly 3% to 10% by 2030. For Gater, achieving those goals will require broader structural changes to an industry that, until last year, was not even required by law to provide separate toilets for women. Alongside its training programs, Build Her now works with dozens of firms on issues ranging from harassment and equal pay to basic conditions for women on construction sites. Looking ahead, Gater sees a future where ensuring women's safety, dignity, and inclusion in the industry is no longer a constant battle, allowing more of them to focus on bigger ambitions. I see more and more women starting their own businesses. I see women's collectives bidding for contracts independently, she says. We shouldn't still be advocating for breadcrumbs. Further inside the development, a few residents lean over the metal balconies of newly completed apartment blocks, topped with solar water heaters, watching workers move through the exposed concrete interiors of a neighboring building, still wrapped in scaffolding and green mesh sheeting. In a first-floor unit that overlooks a gravel path and a small wetland area, 22-year-old Margaret Klamaitha kneels on the floor, cutting and fitting bathroom tiles. Klamaitha completed Build Her's 6-month tiling program last year and now works on a rolling 3-month contract at Tattoo City, her first full-time construction job. Though she says she enjoys the work, she sees it as a stepping stone. One day, she hopes to move into quality control, then eventually start her own construction-related business. It's all about the mindset, she says. Once you start to do something as a woman, don't let anyone put you down. From L. I was told forever I'd never work after 40. Instead, at 54, Jennifer Garner is thriving. The five-star Weekend actress and co-star Gemma Chan spoke to Elle UK about cooking, Chloe Sevigny, and the power of female friendship by Chiara Wilkinson. For Jennifer Garner, nothing beats a classic girls' weekend away, complete with sweatpants, pizza, and dancing like no one is watching. In her new series, The Five-Star Weekend, which is streaming on Peacock now, the archetypal girls' trip is taken to the next level. Adapted from the 2023 novel by Ellen Hildebrand, Garner plays Hollis Shaw, a famous food blogger who suffers a life-changing loss and plans a weekend away by the coast in an attempt to process her grief, inviting four friends from different phases of her life and greeting them each with a gift basket. None of these women had met each other before the trip. And of course, not everything goes quite to plan. Characters clash, secrets are spilled, and new bonds are forged over the course of the 8 45-minute episodes. The series' all-star cast, also including Chloe Sevigny, Gemma Chan, Regina Hall, and Darcy Carden, has also never met prior to filming. "I was so nervous to meet Chloe," Garner tells me. "Our careers circled each other, but we've never been in anything together. She's been on a pedestal for me." Gemma Chan agrees, confirming that Sevigny is the ultimate cool girl. They needn't have worried. After filming scenes playing a game of Never Have I Ever, running into the sea, and a pajama dance party in the freezing cold, "There was no alcohol involved, but it looks like there was," Garner says. The five women bonded in no time. On the small screen, it's still relatively rare to see stories about female friendship, especially midlife female friendship, portrayed with depth and nuance. This is something Garner, who is also executive producer of the series, hopes will change going forward. "I hope people will watch this and have a blast," she says. "You have women in their 30s, 40s, 50s, talking about perimenopause and menopause, but it's not pedantic and it's not an eye roll. It's just presented as part of life. Talking about kids, comparing kids, success and failure, marriage being hard." That honesty is partly what makes this story feel refreshing. We're all fed this idea that this has to happen by this age, and this has to happen by then. And it just isn't that way, Garner says. It's all so much more open. "I'm 54, and I was told forever I would never work after 40. Knock on wood, and we'll see, but I'm still here." If she were to give her younger self advice at the start of her career, "Don't stop learning other things," Garner says. "Don't make this your whole world. It's kind of impossible sometimes, but stay open to the rest of the world. For Garner, that's cooking as much as she can, much like her character, Hollis. She even has her own pretend cooking show on Instagram, and spending time with her three children, whom she shares with her ex-husband, Ben Affleck. Now, 2 decades after the filming of the original 13 Going on 30, it's been reported that she is on board as an executive producer for Netflix's official reboot. It feels as though Garner is enjoying the next chapter of her career. This one, perhaps, feels more closely aligned with the 5-Star Weekend, which asks what happens to women's friendships and identities as we age. It's a question that resonates with the rest of the cast, too. When asked what it takes to sustain these long-term friendships, Chan responds, "I would say a lack of judgment and a bit of forgiveness." Garner concurs, adding, "That's something that you learn as you get older. Just don't let those things get in the way of a real friendship. Even if you haven't spoken in forever, just pick it up. Don't get your feelings hurt by life happening." As for her new 5-Star Weekend friends, "I've learned how rare it is to get to work with a group of women," Garner says. "It is heaven. I don't want to go back." From The Guardian, "We're up against forces that have all the money in the world." Erin Brockovich on her battle against AI data centers, by Zoe Williams. In 1993, she squeezed a $333 million settlement from a Californian energy company in a scandal over contaminated water. 3 decades later, she has a new target in her sights, and it's global. When Erin Brockovich woke to find 30 emails from people from the same town, she realized something was going on. People email Brockovich all the time because of what happened in 1993 when she was instrumental in suing Pacific Gas and Electric Company, PG&E, on behalf of residents of the town of Hinckley, California, whose groundwater had been contaminated. The case resulted in a settlement, then the largest ever payout for a direct action lawsuit. When she was immortalized by Julia Roberts in the 2000 film Erin Brockovich, she became the hero we didn't know we needed, a modern-day Joan of Arc. She had won against PG&E with no formal legal training. The emails she received a few weeks ago were about data centers. In April, she put a call out on her website asking for anyone with concerns about one near them to get in touch. Within a month, 3,862 people had replied. Tech companies have needed data centers to power their technology forever, she says, but the new ones being built to power AI? This feels like Hinckley on steroids. This isn't a story about AI, she says. That genie is out of the bottle. It's here. It's an effective tool. You can use it or not, Brockovich says matter-of-factly. This is about the massive structures being built to house the vast computing facilities AI requires. These data centers, she says, stretch over hundreds and hundreds of acres. In May, Utah gave approval to a center twice the size of Manhattan. Some of the emails Brockovich gets from people near data centers express genuine bafflement. Why did I not know about this? How did this construction just start? Why am I now getting a notice from the city council that this has already passed when I didn't even have a voice in it? Others reflect concerns about the impact of the centers. What about our resources? What's happening to the water? Who's paying for all this energy? And am I going to foot that bill? What will the future impact on health be from these monstrosities? What's going to happen to the wildlife? From the emails, Brockovich built a map of significant AI data centers in the United States that are either operational or under construction, overlaid with locations where community members have emailed in concerns. This open source document is chilling. As of June 24th, 33 AI data centers have been completed and are operational. 68 are under construction, and 41 are proposed. And there had been 7,005 reports submitted through the online form, which is to say, all that is known about them is what people have seen. As a post on her Substack blog is headlined, "If data centers are so great, why are they being built in secret?" It's happening in every U.S. state, multiple counties, rural areas, ranches, farms, and neighborhoods. People watch nature because they respect it, they need it, and they're watching it be destroyed, says Brockovich. She has heard from people saying, "I'm concerned this is where the bald eagles nest. I'm watching wildlife disappear. I'm seeing dead animals." Some communities learn about a center months after it's been approved. Others don't hear anything about them and watch as a vast building emerges. Brockovich, 66 this month, is speaking to me on a video call. She is sitting at a glossy, chunky desk of the type a lawyer might use, the blinds behind her revealing symmetrical stripes of her verdant Southern California neighborhood and her two cheerful little dogs. She comes across as purposeful, approachable, and indefatigable. Data center developers often enter into non-disclosure agreements with local officials, so it is not possible to see why they were approved without environmental impact assessments or input from residents. I am getting reports from people where their local leaders are changing zoning laws for this to happen, she says, incredulous that anyone would bypass democracy to that degree. She does not believe this is a story of sudden nationwide corruption or that local governments are setting out to stonewall residents. What I'm seeing now is that councils, having heard community responses, are trying to hit pause, and they're getting sued by the developments for $100 million+. They cannot withstand that. In one case, Hill County in Texas, county commissioners, not expecting the public outcry over a planned data center, voted on a year-long moratorium to halt building. The county was then sued by the developers for $100 million in damages, and, according to the Texas Tribune, has now backed down. What is certain, though, is that the land cannot withstand these centers' immense demand for water. According to analysis by The Guardian, two-thirds of planned data centers in the U.S. are in drought-stricken areas. The larger centers need up to 5 million gallons of water a day for cooling, equivalent to the average usage of 50,000 people. It is unclear what the plan is and whose needs will take priority between AI, agriculture, and everyone else. People are reporting bill spikes, Brockovich says, reading an email from someone who says their monthly water bill went from $22 to more than $350. The threat of these centers is about more than money. It feels existential. How will the water use disrupt the balance of nature? People are asking, what will happen to us? Brockovich was born and brought up in the Midwest. Her father was an engineer, and her mother was a journalist. That's probably where I got my curiosity. My dad built and ran pipelines for huge companies, and he promised me that in my lifetime, water would be more valuable than gold. He said, "I want you to understand, good stewardship is an obligation for you, because what really matters is your land for your food, your water to sustain life, and the health and welfare of your family. Those are your gifts, and those are your resources." She has a moral certainty, which is what led her into that Hinckley fight, despite not being a lawyer. She was a legal clerk in the PG&E case, then moved into activism and advocacy, and has received honorary degrees from two universities and a law school. I remember being in community meetings, and people would talk to me about that, and I would not be afraid to tell them, "Damned if I know, but let's talk to a lawyer and find out." It was in that fight that she learned that a corporation can withstand a handful of people kicking up a fuss, but it has a problem when 100 people or more are organized and acting in concert. She learned, too, about corporate gaslighting, when we still called it lying. I grew up running in the cornfields and the wheat fields, fascinated with thunderstorms and fireflies. And I assure you, in Kansas, I never saw a two-headed frog. When I got to Hinckley, I saw a two-headed frog. Somebody always wants to try to tell you that what you see, you don't see. I can't tell you how many times I've walked away and gone, "Whoa, wait a minute, did that really happen?" Because someone wants to tell you it didn't. but just as important as her knowledge that sometimes people lie is her nose for when people are telling the truth. Especially in these rural counties, they know themselves, they know their family, they know their animals, they know their land. The environment tells you a story every single day, if you stop and pay attention. After Hinckley, she worked on other environmental pollution cases against PG&E, related to hexavalent chromium, the chemical that contaminated Hinckley's water. More recently, she has focused on PFAS, per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, forever chemicals that are a component in firefighting foam and used heavily on U.S. military bases. PFAS have been linked to health problems, including fertility issues and some cancers. In 2017, communities living near military bases reported worrying levels of these chemicals in their drinking water. Brockovich's renown is plainly the reason people email her when they have concerns. This is what led her to Northwest Georgia last year, where staggeringly high levels of PFAS were found in the water and the wider environment. It was believed that they came from carpet factories that used stain-resistant chemicals. The major carpet factories said they complied with all regulations and no longer use PFAS. She is still supporting people there with their campaigns. Unlike toxic chemicals leaking into water, nothing about data centers is discreet. Signs that might be subtle one day, an absence of birdsong. The next day will be a center, up and running at full volume. It really becomes about the noise, the decibels, Brockovich says. People will write to her and say, "We're going insane, 24/7. It's got to stop. It's humming, it's hissing, it's buzzing," she says. "It's generators, it's increased electric bills, it's power surges." These structures are appearing without the consultation you would need to erect a new sports arena, as if people won't notice. But people certainly will notice, because the buildings are vast. It feels like a step into post-democracy, which is a tech bro fantasy, a world in which laws and regulations have been obviated. The big tech companies seem to have blueprinted their fantasy and started building it. Alternatives are now being mooted. "People are talking about putting them at the bottom of the ocean," says Brockovich. "They're talking about having barges and putting the data centers there, using waves as the energy in cooler climates. Elon Musk wants to put them in space." But with innumerable Earth-based data centers already built or in the works, this feels like puff. The future you could have had, had you not sleepwalked into the one that has arrived. For Brockovich, this is all a distraction. The first thing she wants is a case-by-case moratorium on approving data centers. She is collecting these cases through her open-source mapping site and says councils vary in the action they are prepared to take, according to how surprised by or receptive to local complaints their officials are. Many states are only now stopping to consider whether there should be state-level regulation and oversight of data centers, and if so, what implications that would have for local decision-making and autonomy. This takes time. 79 municipalities in the U.S. so far have issued moratoriums, many immediately being hit with lawsuits for breaking their original deal. Pauses have been introduced in Georgia, Maryland, Michigan, and South Carolina. One introduced in Maine was then vetoed. But these are early interventions against tech behemoths. When I ask Brockovich about the political climate, a president committed to AI and blatantly dismissive of environmental concerns, she is careful to stress that opposition to data centers is bipartisan. She knows from her work fighting PFAs, though, that a change in administration can make an enormous difference to the success of these campaigns. In the final days of Joe Biden's presidency, a cleanup operation was announced by the Pentagon. However, this plan has quietly been delayed by Donald Trump's Department of War. In some areas, it won't start until 2039. Yet the nature of Brockovich's campaigning is not to go straight to the top and demand policy change, but rather to build lawsuits from the ground up. Victory, to her, is won by way of a pragmatic to-do list. To start, she would go to local government and say, "I'd like to see an environmental impact report. I'd like to see how you propose to power all this. Are you going to build your own power? Are you relying on our already strained resources? Let's get that information first, and then have a town hall meeting where the people can be a voice in it." She has a degree of confidence that the law still has teeth. Lawsuits aren't settling for $333 million anymore. They're settling for billions, she says. Brockovich's data center work goes beyond the U.S. She has been contacted by people in Australia, India, Scotland, and Ireland. There is already a moratorium on any more data centers in Dublin. Even by 2023, such centers were accounting for a fifth of Ireland's electricity usage. "This is a planetary thing," she says. "It's overwhelming. We have to have some courage to show up, and it's difficult to do that when you're up against forces that have all the money and all the intelligence and all the bandwidth in the world." She, meanwhile, says she is getting too old for this, by the way. "I'm in my legacy phase. I have 6 grandchildren." She is smiling. All that may be true, but even if this is her final campaign, she won't walk away until it's over. She can beat this. She just can't beat it on her own. From Costco Connection, for your health. Pharmacy update. Listen to your heart. Keep high blood pressure in check. By Linda R. Bernstein, PharmD. High blood pressure is common and can put your health at risk. The Department of Health and Human Services states that almost half of U.S. adults have the condition, also known as hypertension. It can affect all ages. Only about a quarter of adults with hypertension have their blood pressure under control. A normal systolic blood pressure reading, the top number that measures the pressure against your artery walls when your heart contracts, is less than 120 millimeters of mercury, and a diastolic blood pressure reading, the lower number, which measures the pressure against your artery walls between beats, is less than 80 millimeters Hg, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. A high blood pressure reading is consistently at or greater than 130 over 80 mmHg. Healthcare providers diagnose high blood pressure after several readings on separate occasions. There are usually no signs or symptoms of high blood pressure, so it is often called the silent killer. It can increase risk of a heart attack, stroke, heart failure, kidney disease or failure, vision loss, sexual dysfunction, heart disease and angina, and plaque buildup, according to the American Heart Association. Call 911 if chest pain, shortness of breath, back pain, numbness, weakness, change in vision, or difficulty speaking occur, as they may indicate a serious blood pressure medical emergency. Lifestyle changes are usually a first step to reducing high blood pressure. Here are a few examples. Start regular physical activity. Quit smoking. Eat more fresh fruits, vegetables, whole grains, low-fat dairy products, skinless poultry and fish, nuts and legumes. Limit saturated and trans fats, alcohol, salt, fatty and processed meats, and high sugar items. Maintain a healthy weight and address any other health conditions. There are many things you can do to proactively manage your high blood pressure. It's important for your health to stick with a plan you develop with your healthcare provider. And that brings us to the end of the program. I'm Mary Ellen. Thank you for joining me. And please join me again for the Women's Hour.
This is Bird Note. When a pair of Western grebes decides it's time to mate, it's as if they know they have an audience for the performance they're about to give. On the still waters of an alkaline lake, they call loudly and approach one another. Each bird curves, then straightens its long neck gracefully. They then face each other, necks on the water's surface, their bills flipping up drops of water. If attraction prevails, they rush together and off they go across the water, running on the surface side by side. Standing straight up with necks held high and feet churning like propellers, they no longer look much like grebes, more like participants in Tchaikovsky's ballet Swan Lake. After their lengthy pas de deux, with wings extended like parallel sails, they plunge below the surface. What follows is the weed ceremony, each bird diving to pick up a beakful of soft vegetation. The grebes then stand up in the water, face one another, press tightly together, then drop the plants and preen. The whole courtship sequence may begin again at any time, building in intensity as spring progresses and the pair makes ready to start a new generation. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Would you like to hear news from Shrewsbury, Northborough, Southborough, and Westborough that you're not likely to hear on commercial television or radio? Then tune in to Audio Journal every Tuesday at 4 p.m.